Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is its fourth series. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We welcome your feedback. In autumn 2024, I had the remarkable privilege of accompanying two international lawyers, Alofipo Saolo Fleur Ramsey and Watna Mori, to the remote village of Verebari on the Kikori River in Papua New Guinea. They are part of a team of lawyers from Blue Ocean Law in Guam, who are working with a group of Pacific nation states who campaigned for and achieved a reference to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion on climate change. For the benefit of non-lawyers, the International Court of Justice is the highest judicial authority in the international legal system, and an advisory opinion is a decision where the ICJ declares the status of international law with respect to a particular subject. The UN General Assembly, in this case pushed by Vanuatu, adopted a resolution that defined the questions that the ICJ was required to address. We give many more details about the advisory opinion in the discussion that follows. The village of Verebari in Papua New Guinea is on the front line of climate and biodiversity destruction. This community of 1,000 people with several hundred children have already had to move five times in the period of the last several decades in order to contend with the impacts of climate change, sea level rise, and the increasing force of the river tides. The shoreline of the village has changed at an accelerating rate, and with this have come the problems of increased salinity, leading to a loss of fresh water, and most crucially, the loss of trees that are so central to the cosmological and ceremonial life of the community. So Verebari gives a deep texture and meaning to the implications of the International Court of Justice advisory opinion on climate change. I recorded a conversation for Countersign with Watna and Fleur while I was on site at Verebari. And what you hear along with the extraordinary insights they have to offer is the sounds of village life. And I think that conveys something more than the complex legal arguments on what's at stake in this ICJ advisory opinion. A community with a rich and nuanced culture who have lived in this area of the Kikori River since time immemorial are now backed up against a swamp with nowhere else to go. And notwithstanding this, they showed me and my fellow travelers the most extraordinary hospitality and generosity while we visited. And for this, I thank all of them very much. My thanks also to Amir Kangisa for lending me their microphone and recording the conversation that we conducted on site at Verebari. The conversation that Fleur, Watna and I had at Verebari is framed by a more recent conversation I had with Fleur to give more context to climate destruction in the Pacific and the implications of the ICJ advisory opinion. So we will start with the recently recorded discussion with Fleur, then move to the conversation at Verebari, and then I close with a further discussion about the hearings at the ICJ in December 2024 and look ahead to what we might expect from the International Court of Justice. We're having this conversation several months after we were in Verebari in October of 2024. And then in December 2024, the ICJ held its oral hearings in the advisory opinion on climate change. So a lot has happened. Just to go backwards a bit, what first took you to Veribari and why is Veribari so important?
So I work with Blue Ocean Law, and we're engaged by the Melanesian Spearhead Group. And that group is a collection of Melanesian countries. They wanted to ensure that the voices of communities are heard. And so Watner and I already knew about Veribari through Piku Biodiversity, which is this incredible NGO working in the Kokori region. And so that's pretty much why we went there. We had links and connections, and we also knew that they were suffering from climate change impacts.
Mm-hmm. And when you first went to Veribari, what did you encounter?
So it was in December 2023. It was the first time that I had been there, the first time that Watner had been there, who's my colleague. And
Watner's from Papua New Guinea, so yeah.
Watner's from Papua New Guinea. I didn't know what to expect, and I did get a little bit of a shock because I knew about this community. I knew that they had to keep relocating because of sea level rise. They live in a delta region. I just didn't quite comprehend how quick and rapid that sea level rise had become. And so when I got there, what I was witness to was a village that was struggling, and you could see the ruins of what used to be the village, which at low tide, which then would be covered by water. And I stayed in a building which now no longer exists. So the second time I went back, it's not there. And already the water was smashing into that building. And so I saw a community that was under a lot of stress from sea level rise and having to move in a very small space where there's not much land left for them.
Mm-hmm. And you were very kind to ask me to come along, as you and other Blue Ocean Law lawyer Watner Mori and others made this incredible journey back to Veribari, first flying to Port Moresby and then going in a very small charter plane to Kikori and taking quite a dramatic, beautiful boat ride for a few hours down to Veribari. What was it like for you going back?
It was extremely emotional going back because I think the first time we went, they were having a climate change conference, and I don't think they quite comprehended what we were doing there, in the sense that they didn't understand how big this case was. The second time when we came back again, I think they recognized that. And, you know, relationships are very important in the Pacific. They recognized that we were invested in them because we were coming back again. And they were ready and waiting for us. And the whole community was there to welcome us. There was dancing, there was gift giving. And as soon as I saw that, I started to cry because I was so affected by the first time I was there by how much this community is suffering from the climate change impacts, that it really meant a lot for me to go back and to reconnect with that community and to see this time they were really engaged as a whole community in this process.
Mm. No, it was really moving and emotional for me as well. I was really blown away by the generosity of the welcome, that the village had been made ready and decorated. And there was that really powerful ritual that Mr. Ara, the leader of the village, gave a packet of soil to Watner.
Yeah.
Who was the leader of our group. And he said words to the effect that with this soil, this becomes your land and home temporarily, and you need to return this soil to me when you leave. But it was this really extraordinary. I mean, when we think about the way refugees and foreigners are treated in the Western world or in Australia, this moment of greeting where the and I think he used the words home away from home, that there was really an invocation of home. So we're talking about a place where the people's home is so under threat from climate devastation, and still this incredible generosity.
Exactly. I was just going to say it's also the mark of being hosted by having that soil. We were completely safe and protected.
Mm-hmm.
The whole privilege were there to answer our questions and to talk to us and really get involved in the process. And so that was, like, I think not just a symbolic gesture, but a material one as well, because of the impact that the way that that built the relationship between us and the village.
Yeah. So there have been sort of formal statements that have been submitted in relation to Veribari to the International Court of Justice. So as a village, it's a very significant part of the MSG, so the Melanesian Spearhead Group submissions, for instance, and Mr. Ara's testimony features at the beginning. What other kind of sort of evidence gathering were you doing with other lawyers in Veribari?
Yeah, so mainly the Pacific is a very unique place. There's 1,400 languages there, and people are, there's a kind of important connective tissue between people and place, and that connected tissue is often built by language, but it's also built by the knowledge of the place. And so there's incredible detailed knowledge of everything in a village or in a place, and it's built off, obviously, the environment, the land, the sea, the oceans, biodiversity. And so climate change obviously has a significant impact on environment. You know, sea level rise, it affects land, it affects soil, you know, it takes places, it affects growing foods. It has, like, multiple impacts. And those impacts, because people place peoples, because their languages are what I call ecologically derived languages, so the languages come from the land itself, it has a flow-on effect on the entire cosmos, the entire world of these people. And so that was pretty much what we wanted to do. We wanted to get a sense of what that connective tissue or what that connection is that people have. And it's different because if you've got, you know, 1,400 languages, it's going to be expressed in multiple different ways. And so in order to show that, you need to go to the community and talk to them and get a sense of what their connection is with that place and what it is that they're losing. And so that pretty much was our task when we were there, to talk to people and to understand what the actual impacts of climate change are beyond, you know, I mean, people don't even think about this because the physical and their relationship are bound up together, but beyond what we would consider just the environmental impacts.
Absolutely. And this sense of language deriving from the land, I mean, that's in Mr. Ara's statement, which is submitted to the ICJ, but also this phrase that you've just used, that people in the Pacific are place-based peoples. And this is something that comes up in the context of Vanuatu's submissions. And I know that you also, as part of the work you did with Blue Ocean Law, traveled to Vanuatu, Samoa, Fiji, and these Pacific...
New Caledonia,
very importantly, also part of the Melanesian Spearhead Group. How is climate change impacting on those islands and peoples? Just to expand out
Veribari. So it's different in each place, as I was saying, because of the uniqueness of each place. So I went to Tanna Island, which is in Vanuatu as well. And I went to Yakau Village, which is what's called a custom village in Vanuatu. So there's villages in Vanuatu that's rejected the influence of missionaries and the influence of the West, and they live a traditional lifestyle. And in this village, they've been growing yams from time immemorial. And the yam in Melanesia is an extremely special crop, very special in Yakau, and so special that it has a guardian. There's one family that's the guardian, called a tapunas of the yam, and they told us that they haven't been able to grow yams for the last 5 years. And so when we inquired further, because they're master gardeners, because they've been doing it forever, they were able to say, well, there's too much rain, the rain's coming at a different time, or it's too hot. So they were explaining what we know is the pattern or trend in the climate science, which is impacting their crop. Now, again, you might say, can't they go and buy it from the market, or can't they try and grow it somewhere else? There is status. There's something spiritually important for them to grow yams themselves on their own land. And those yams are central in all of their ceremonies, including when they choose a chief.
Mm-hmm.
And so without that yam, all of those ceremonies are devalued to the point that they probably won't be.
Mm-hmm.
They won't undertake those ceremonies anymore. So that's this is an example where I was saying it's not just the loss of a crop or food, it's actually a loss of the underpinning of a cultural system.
Absolutely. And of course the yam and tanna as a place feature heavily in Vanuatu's submissions to the International Court of Justice. And that brings us, I think, quite neatly to what's legally at stake in the advisory opinion and issues of self-determination, the importance of culture, a whole raft of human rights that are now what's at issue in the ICJ advisory opinion. So could you say a little bit about, you know, what are some of the important legal categories that were engaged by this evidence that you and others gathered from the Pacific?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say the argument of what is at stake in the ICJ was an argument itself, because basically...
So explain that a bit more, yeah.
Yeah, I will explain it. So we have, as you know, a climate regime, which is the Paris Agreement, the UNFCCC, so which is the Framework Convention on Climate Change. Framework Convention on Climate Change is around 1992, and this is considered the climate change regime. And the question for the court, or the question, or the major argument that was before the court, is what obligations exist under international law in relation to greenhouse gas emissions by states.
Mm-hmm.
And is it confined to this climate change regime, or can we open it up to other obligations that states might have, such as human rights obligations, the right to self-determination, the prohibition on environmental transboundary harm. So that was the major question of whether we narrow what we're looking at, what the obligations of states are in relation to climate change, or whether we open it up and say, no, actually the states have a wide range of obligations, including human rights obligations, and those obligations affect what states can do in relation to greenhouse gas emissions. So that was pretty much the major argument, which fell into two different camps.
Yeah. Now, I think we'll...
Broadly.
I think we'll... No, that's really helpful. And I think we'll come back to that. But to put it really simply, particularly for those listeners who might not be international lawyers, many states, particularly the states that you might call more reasonable states, so not the really far out marginal ones, but let's say states like Australia, who acknowledge that there is massive damage happening from climate change, take the position that the operative law begins effectively in 1992 with the United Nations Framework Agreement on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, and the schema that it put in place that culminates in the Paris Agreement in 2015. And what other nation states and small island nation states in particular, who are much more vulnerable, are saying is no, all international law, the entire body of international law, including customary norms, so-called jus cogens, norms of international law, all of this applies, and the International Court of Justice need to bring all of that to bear on this advisory opinion. Now, let's move along. So let's just say, for the purposes of our conversation here, we also obviously went to Veribari and recorded a conversation while we were in the village. And our listeners will now hear that. And then we'll return to discuss what it was like at The Hague in December when you and other lawyers gathered to make submissions to the International Court of Justice. Wat Namori and Alo Fipo, Saolo Fleur Ramsey, it's great to be with you here at Veribai Village. Let's start with, where is Veribai and why is it significant that you're here for the preparation of the hearings of the International Court of Justice?
Thank you, Stuart. Veribai is a village in the Kikori Delta. It's just at the mouth of the river where it enters the Gulf of Papua. It's one of the few remaining villages along the Kikori Delta. and it's being heavily impacted by climate change. We started working with the Varibari community maybe three or four years ago, and this is our second visit to Varibari, and it's our second visit to Varibari to gather evidence for the International Court of Justice in these advisory proceedings on climate change and state obligations.
Okay, so for listeners of this podcast who are not familiar with the work of the ICJ, Fleur, could you explain a little bit about how the proceedings commenced? Mm-hmm. What's the procedure for that, and who spearheaded the demand for a advisory opinion on climate change?
Yes, so it started in a classroom at the University of South Pacific in Vanuatu. Some students were in a law class, and following that class they decided to try and go to Pacific governments and ask them to take action on climate change, because up to that stage the negotiations under the United Nations Framework Convention of Climate Change was failing. Even though the Pacific are leaders there, we're heading towards probably 3 to 4 degrees based on current estimates, so it's not working for the Pacific. So the students had the idea, and Vanuatu took it up, and this is in 2019. At the time, a lot of people thought that it was impossible to get the question before the International Court of Justice. So what is the International Court of Justice, and why does it matter? The International Court of Justice is the court of the United Nations. It's the highest court. Because it's the court of the United Nations, it has its limitations, and its limitations is that only states mm-hmm. are able to appear before the court, or some intergovernmental organisations can as well, but they still have to be connected to states. In relation to why it's important, well, Vanuatu wanted to ensure that the highest court dealt with this particular question, again, because a lot of the fossil fuel producing states and a lot of the high emitters aren't from the Pacific. And so Vanuatu wanted some clarity in relation to what the legal obligations of states are, particularly those states that have caused the bulk of the greenhouse gas emissions, and in relation to Pacific states, because our contribution is negligible.
Fleur, you were talking about the process at the ICJ, and one of the priorities of Pacific Ocean nations being that they wanted to press the ICJ to respond to the fact that most emitters are not in the Pacific. So do you want to say a little bit more about the process of how the advisory opinion was commissioned?
Yeah, so Vanuatu spearheaded it, and they decided that they would draft the question, so they didn't open it up to all the other states, and that was to try and protect the integrity of the question, with the question dealing with the who's responsible, because most states didn't want to have to deal with that question. They then formed an alliance with a core group of states, including some of the bigger states like New Zealand and Germany. And that's when they started opening it up for negotiation. And it took 3 years. Mm-hmm. But eventually the General Assembly passed it by consensus. And so that question then went to the International Court of Justice, and that's why we're here today.
Absolutely. And we know that there have been other recent, very significant advisory opinions handed down by the ICJ, specifically the advisory opinion on the Chagos archipelago and decolonization needing to be completed by Britain. So the ICJ is very important. You've been working with the community for a period of years, Watna. How do you come to be working with this community in Varibari?
We found out about Varibari through someone that Fleur and I worked with at another organization. Her name's Samantha Kuman. So she was working with the Center for Environment Law and Community Rights in PNG. And she told us about Yolane Amepu, who is the head of Piku Biodiversity Network. Samantha talked to me about, you know, this particular community that Yolani is working with, that we're experiencing the impacts of climate change at quite a rapid rate. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to Yolani, and Fleur and I was at this other environmental law organization, assisted the community to make a submission to the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Climate Change on the issue of loss and damage. So PIKU asked the Center of Environment and Community Rights and the community themselves, who had formed a resettlement committee to try and get this resettlement, you know, organize this fifth relocation. We made this submission together. So that was our first bit of work together with the community. You know, what Yolani said to us was, this is great, but the community at large doesn't know much about just the term climate change on its own, or the science behind it, let alone the politics behind climate change. They had been trying to make sense of it within their own sort of cosmologies and understandings of the world and of, you know, their environment that's very closely linked to them. And this was being sort of stretched to its limits.
In what ways were the community's cosmologies being pushed to the limit? And Yolani Amepu, who's a marine biologist, was doing a different kind of work here with turtles, for example. And how did that work and the challenges that the Baribari village community were experiencing, how did this come together? Because as you mentioned, they had to relocate on multiple occasions because of the rise of the river and the tides coming further and further into the village.
Yolani started coming to Baribari, I think from around 2014. And every year that she came back, she noticed what was happening here. Mm-hmm. And she knew it was, you know, the impacts of climate change. But she was focused on this conservation work. She also, it's a very small organization. She came out here to do a conservation, like a project, a particular project, and then realized this, it doesn't work when you just come in, do your job, and, you know, take this information and then go out again, and no one's actually staying with the community to keep the project, sort of get them invested in the project or have them be part of the project. So that's when she decided to start PIKU. So it was very small, and she felt like she couldn't really expand to, you know, take on this climate change work. But then it got to a point where social problems were starting to be created because people couldn't make sense of how quickly, you know, their shoreline was being taken, their homes, things that were significant to them, places that were significant to them. So they started, you know, relying on some of their understanding of the world, their worldviews, that, you know, they always felt, because this is a delta area, islands form, mm-hmm. islands drop away some parts, mm-hmm. and then there are parts that have always been there, like Baribari,
yes.
where the people have never moved from, you know, never migrated. They don't have migration stories with canoes that moved from here to there or everywhere, like they were always here. But with these sort of island sandbars that form and disappear, they have people that they know that are able to communicate with and have relationship with environments to make this sort of happen. So it's part of their beliefs, but when it got pushed to the limit, they started blaming people mm-hmm. for this, for the harm that was being caused to them. And that's when Yolani knew that she had to start talking mm-hmm. to them about climate change. So what it was, that it wasn't something really within their sphere of influence. It wasn't something that someone in their village caused. It was something beyond them, but not something unimaginable to them, because right yes. within the Kikori River, they yes. have gas pipelines, oil and gas pipelines that go out, owned by, you know, ExxonMobil, Oil Min, who is now owned by Santos.
Yes.
They also have Total developing a project in the Gulf province. So it's not totally, it's not a concept that's like too far away from for them to understand. But it also is at the same time, because you're telling them people somewhere out there with this thing that's going out through your rivers, you know, through your river, these pipelines that are going out through your river, people out there are then burning it, and it's affecting your weather and your, you know, climate here, all the way here. But these people all the way out there in this place called Europe, in this place called the United States of America, places that, you know, they're unlikely to ever see. So it was both a very foreign but also kind of familiar concept.
Yeah, I mean, you've captured a really complex relationship there in a wonderful way, Watna, which is that people who live here along the Kikori already have a cosmology to understand that the transformations that take place in the river can be affected by what is not immediately visible to them. Except in the case of climate change, what is not immediately visible is the burning of the fossil fuel that is causing the climate change by and large. So, and as you say, there's, you know, just around here in the Kikori are those ways and means by which resources are extracted, minerals are extracted, and that is leading to climate change. So, Fleur, coming to you now, could you just tell us a little bit more about how MSG has, and just maybe say a little bit more about MSG and who they are, and what your hopes and expectations are of the ICJ in this context?
Yep, so the MSG means Melanesian Spearhead Group, and it's an intergovernmental organisation that includes Fiji, Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, and also the pro-independence movement of New Caledonia. And they wanted to be involved because they're particularly concerned about the important things about Melanesia, what makes Melanesia a very rich place. And what makes Melanesia a very rich place is the connection between culture and biodiversity. So they wanted to ensure that the impacts that climate change is having on people's lives and the way and their cosmologies, as well as their environment and the precious things that are important to them in terms of biodiversity, is captured and put before the court, so the court understands the kind of harm and impacts that are happening here. The other thing that they were very interested in looking at is youth, because we're sitting in Verabai village. It's a very young village, a lot of children.
We can hear the children going up and down the river.
You can hear them playing. And so there is going to be a massive impact on young people in the Pacific and in this region. So one of the things that they wanted us to do was to go out to communities and talk to communities and put their statements and their voices before the International Court of Justice, so the International Court of Justice understands what's been lost, what's been destroyed, what's been taken in the Pacific, particularly in the Melanesian countries.
Yes, so there's a lot of legal conceptual work to be done on what is being lost and what the damage is. But before we get to that, there is an important jurisdictional question, and you're anticipating that the Inter-American Court is going to address that jurisdictional question slightly differently. So first, could you say a little bit more about what that jurisdictional question is, and why is it important that the ICJ determine that question in relation to trans-border harm in a particular way?
Yeah, so I just take a very quick step backwards and say that the question that's before the International Court of Justice asks the court what states' obligations are from a broad range of international legal doctrine, not just the climate change regime, which is the Paris Agreement, the UNFCCC. That is because the Pacific thinks it's also a human rights issue and a transboundary harm issue, which is another kind of environmental issue. And one of the kind of jurisdictional points which will come up before the court will be what obligations states have to non-citizens for damage that they cause outside their boundaries. And because the human rights regime at the moment is really based on the obligation that a state has to their own citizens, we anticipate, because they've already done this, that the international, so the Inter-American Court of Human Rights will say that it also comes up in a transboundary issue, and you are under the jurisdiction of the state that is where the activity takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is fundamentally important, otherwise there's going to be a massive injustice, because it's a human rights issue. Climate crisis is a human rights issue, and our states aren't causing the problem. And when you look at Pacific states, it's negligible. It's 0.001
yes.
Percent of contributions to global greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes.
Ferrybury was the first place that we came to.
Yeah.
And when we came here, we stayed at a house at the front of this village. That was in November last year, November 2023. That house is no longer there.
Exactly.
And we're now in the resettlement, in this fifth relocation site.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is also facing the same issues that the front house was facing. So.
Yeah. And go on, Flo.
I just wanted to follow up on that, because I think even we understand we're Pacific people. So we understand that climate change is happening in the Pacific and has been happening for a long time. When Watner and I first wrote the submission to the special rapporteur, we were only taking information that we were told, and we saw some photos. When we came here, we were devastated
mm-hmm.
because I don't think we even imagined how dire the situation is for the community, and particularly in the last few years, the sea level rise has been so rapid. So as Watner said, we stayed in a place which is already gone, and we've seen a lot of changes even in the space of a year, but the women are talking now that it's a matter of weeks
yes.
that their shoreline is changing.
Yes. So, yeah, you've been, well, we've been here over the last few days, been holding workshops, making space for men and women to ensure that each has their voice heard, and you'll be speaking to younger people tomorrow. And part of what has been talked about is the specific losses, examples of specific loss and damage that has taken place. I wonder if you want to say a little bit about what some of those examples are, and perhaps connect them to some of the categories of international law and human rights, because ultimately that's what the ICJ is going to have to recognize and act upon.
Yeah, well, I think we're lucky because we're standing on the shoulders of Indigenous people who mm-hmm. have changed human rights. And they've changed human rights because they've used the right to culture in really creative ways to also include a right to protect the environment. Because for Pacific peoples, as with other Indigenous peoples, our lives are entwined with place. We're place-based peoples. In the Pacific in particular, there's 1,400 languages, and each one of those languages are tied to place, and so they open the world. It's a cosmology in itself, and so we talk to the community here who already identified, for example, a particular tree, and that tree to them also held a spirit man. And that spirit man was central to one of their ceremonies in relation to when a baby is born, and a month after the uncles introduced the baby to the land and to the rest of the people, they invited the spirit man of that tree to then join in the festivities, and that spirit man is what makes the festivities joyous and beautiful. And we've seen that that tree is already being destroyed most recently by the sea level rise, and it was in the centre of the village. So that's an example of how culture and, I hate to use the term nature, but people's vital spaces include trees, which also have a profound significance to their entire lives.
And, of course, there are many children in this village. It's a village of around 1,000 people. It's hardly appropriate to call it a village because it's what people would call a town in lots of other spaces. And the school has been destroyed multiple times. And so the children don't have anywhere to go to school at the moment. So, I mean, is that part of what you will be pushing the court to recognize, the loss of culture that comes from the inability to educate children about their traditions, their customs, the knowledge that has been passed on from generation to generation?
Yeah, I mean, across, this is not just for Varraybarry, for all the, literally all the communities that we've got testimonies from, is this concern that they won't be able to, as the physical places and the physical things disappear, they won't be able to, they'll just become stories. So they won't be able to point to this place and say, this is where the spirit men lived, that, you know, so it just becomes like a myth, and it's not this. This, and that's when the separation occurs.
Right.
This separation between the human and, you know, this is human, this is nature.
Right.
Because you're no longer able to say the spirit person is there and this is the connection to us. This is the story of, you know, this spirit person or this, you know, this is a story from Varraybarry, a belief of Varraybarry that there was a woman who gave birth to a snake who lies in this sandbar, called Gemma, who lies in the sandbar in front of the village. But Gemma's home is being threatened. They haven't seen Gemma in a while.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of, that becomes a legend. And they've already said to us, you know, the fear is that as you separate, as the spirits leave, and you know, there's distance between the spirit and them, that they're, that there's an isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the interpretation of that is then we have this, you know, nature and human separation, that's what's going to happen. And it is, you know, the right to culture is the right to pass on this information, this knowledge to the next generation. And, you know, if we're talking about the children, you know, beyond the right to culture, I mean, apart from the right to culture, you know, their rights as children to be educated, to have, you know, sufficient, you know, food and water. They don't even have a fresh water source here anymore because of the salination of the of their fresh water sources. So there's, these are definitely arguments that we're...
Absolutely. And I mean, I think you make a really good point about, you know, how culture and nature is often separated, especially in Western traditions. And here, when we've been talking to people in the village, you know, one of the things they've talked a lot about is the loss of the trees and how much the particular flowers would indicate something about the tide and the strength of the tide. And of course, that is a direct interaction with the trees that is now potentially going to become only a story because the tree is no longer in front of their house because it's been washed away, basically. So I'm conscious of the time, and you've all been working incredibly hard today. But Fleur, do you want to add to that?
Well, because I want to say that that's why I call it climate dispossession, because it's basically making us Western. You know, like it's impoverishing. They talk about the fact that they had an abundance that they're now impoverished. Climate change is it's a form of theft, which is impoverishing us. And so we've got a wealth and a richness which is our own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in our cultures, it's in our language, it's in our vital spaces. And so what that's been taken from us. It's a form of dispossession, and it means that when, you know, we're not, we live here as Indigenous peoples, like that. That's what gets lost. It's dispossession.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that understanding of dispossession is one of the things that the International Court of Justice and other activists need to start to recognise. And finally, of course, you know, the people of Varraybarry are resisting all of this. They're campaigning. The fact that we're here is part of the fact that they've got tremendous agency and a movement to resist this. So what do you think other peoples, and you've travelled to other parts of the Pacific, what can they learn from the people of Veribari?
All the communities that I've visited, mm-hmm. they're very keen that their voices are heard before the International Court of Justice. And we've seen already some very beautiful communal processes around consent, around being part of this process. That's agency, and it's also their self-determination. And so they want the world to know what's happening to them, and they want justice. So we've heard justice quite a lot, and that's every message that we've heard. And they also know, you know, some of them have seen factories and they've seen the smoke, and they're like, that's affecting our gardens. They know that that something is happening which is affecting them, and they want whoever's responsible to take responsibility for it.
Well, do you want to add anything more?
I'd say, you know, I think there are a lot of other communities like Veribari. Veribari's story was able, like, I mean, we're able to take Veribari's story to the International Court of Justice because of people like Yolani, Amepu, and Piku Biodiversity Network. So I know that there are a lot of communities like Veribari that don't have these champions, and that's why they're not, you know, necessarily, we're not able to reach them all. And there's only also few of us doing this kind of work. So I don't know if I mean, there are. I wouldn't say there's things that other communities can learn from Veribari, because I feel like a lot of communities are doing the best that they can, and that if there are more, you know, other people who can be, or people in those communities themselves or from those communities who are able to go back to their communities and be champions for their communities to, you know, elevate their voices, that would be amazing.
So, Fleur, on the 2nd of December 2024, the oral hearings commenced in The Hague, in the Netherlands, where the International Court of Justice is located. Just describe what it was like to be there on that first day. I was watching it, or as much of it as possible, live from London. And I was just moved, so emotional to see. And I get I'm emotional just thinking about it now, just the visceral sense of some people who had maybe never been to Northern Europe or to The Hague arriving with a really strong set of arguments and demands to be made of the ICJ.
Yes, so the case itself was unprecedented, and it was unprecedented in a couple of ways. So it was unprecedented because it's the largest case in the ICJ history. 91 states and intergovernmental organizations provided submissions. Oh, actually 121, 91 at the oral hearing. So it was massive on that, in that respect. It was also big in another respect, which is a lot of small island developing states, so Pacific Island states and Caribbean states, turned up to the court for the first time and had never, ever submitted in front of the court before.
Why is that? I mean, just say a little bit more about that. I mean, why is that important? And what does it say about the International Court of Justice in its role in this advisory opinion, that all these states who had never participated in this kind of proceeding were there? And what kind of responsibility does that open up in relation to the ICJ?
Yeah, I think I always think back to what Samoa said in its oral submissions. So Samoa, which is similar to many Pacific states, said to the court, and I think the court, you could see there was a bit of surprise on the judges' faces, but Samoa said, we don't have an army.
Mm-hmm.
We're not part of any military grouping.
Yes.
And we do not have an armed, internal police force. So the police force is not armed. And so we are heavily reliant on the rule of law. And I felt that was an extremely profound moment for the court, because I think it showed the court how important this ruling will be to Pacific states, how seriously we take international law, and that it has to respond to the needs of its members.
Mm-hmm.
And those members that are particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and have not caused it. That's the really important part. Mm-hmm. So the contribution of the Pacific is statistically negligible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's less than 1%
of greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was, I think it was profoundly important in that respect of saying we're here to help to develop the rule of law. And a lot of the states like Vanuatu got up and said, we didn't get our independence until 1980.
Yes.
We didn't develop this. The Federated States of Micronesia said the same thing. We were not here when this system was developed, but we're here now. And this is how we wish to see it being developed.
Yes.
And I think because of that, the court was witness to a vision of international law that wouldn't have been presented and certainly wasn't presented by the states, the more powerful states in our globe.
What a brilliant point. I mean, Samoa is basically saying we stand for the rule of law and you should stand with us. We don't have armies. We don't have an armed police force. And in fact, when you were speaking, I was reminded of that extraordinary moment when Nelson Mandela, when he addresses the court at his trial for treason, the Rivonia trial, and he says to the judge, who's this apartheid judge, potentially going to issue a death penalty against him, Nelson Mandela says, I stand for the law. You know, I am the law in the court here. I'm the one who's representing what the rule of law stands for. And so I think, I mean, this kind of moment is really extraordinary. And what was the sense from other nation states? As you say, you know, there were, you know, 90 odd oral submissions. Were there others that stood out to you, either from small island states or indeed from the other side?
I think it's interesting. So we talk about the big states, Germany, Australia, New Zealand. You know, it did broadly fall into two major camps, and that is fossil fuel producers and high emitters, and then the other camp, which is broadly the global south. And maybe, you know, you have countries like South Africa who took a very different approach around rights to development. So they weren't totally on our side, but they weren't necessarily on the high emitters and producer side either. And I think what struck me was Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom put extremely technical arguments around the climate change regime, which we've already discussed. They're saying this is central, this is all that matters, you don't need to look anywhere else. Mm-hmm. They do acknowledge that climate change is the greatest issue. Mm-hmm. But what was missing from that was the impacts on people, the impacts on communities.
Yes. Yes.
And I think what I loved about what the Pacific brought and the Caribbean as well was to really bring to life and to show how climate change is affecting the minutiae of life in those places.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a stark contrast. But I just also wanted to say one other thing, which I think is really important to note, that the reason why Vanuatu and other states wanted to say, well, there's a wider kind of swath of international law that you need to take account of. It's important from a temporal basis because we know that greenhouse gas emissions have been emitted into the atmosphere since the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that knowledge of the impacts that these emissions will have on the environment have been known probably also from the late 1800s, but definitively known from around about 1960, which is well before the UNFCCC, which is 1992. And so what we are saying is that actually greenhouse gas emissions were unlawful well before 1992, because you had all these other international law principles or treaties which applied before that date. And so the major one is due diligence, or the requirement of states to ensure that they're not harming other states when they undertake an activity in their territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that that principle arguably starts at the end of the 1800s as well.
Yes.
Definitively early 1900s, which means that states have already been in breach from the knowledge point, which is 1960 onward. And that's a critically important point, I think, because it means that they were already acting unlawfully before the UNFCCC and Paris Agreement comes in. It then activates what's called the rules of state responsibility, which means if you're doing something unlawfully, you then have to stop it and provide reparations.
Yes.
So that was also the really important kind of aspect of this case.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, you talked about the technical arguments launched by, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, etc. But I mean, when I read these submissions, I'm just in awe at, you know, the submissions of Vanuatu and MSG, the Melanesian Spearhead Group, Samoa, and others, who are just, you know, really, it's an amazing archive. And for listeners who are interested, the ICJ website contains all of the statements, the written submissions of the various countries, and these can be accessed and read and made use of for teaching and other kind of legal practice. And the key argument, I thought, that, you know, stood out for me as really quite a shallow argument made by Australia, just to reference that, was that obligations were between states and not between peoples and individuals. So that was one. The second was, as you've already explained, you know, that the relevant law was the legal framework is UNFCCC from 1992 onwards. And then when we get to loss and damage, which you've just mentioned, they point to collective action and responsibility. So, you know, as you've said, the major emitters, the extractors, those who are trading in fossil fuels and continue to do so at an increasing rate, are telling the world and the most vulnerable of nation states, communities and peoples that everybody is responsible, right? Not particular nation states. I mean, that's also kind of key bit of the submission. So, I mean, could you say a little bit more, and I'm conscious of the time, about loss and damage and, you know, the some of the arguments that you think are important that we should look out for when the ICJ comes down with its decision.
Yeah, I think just going back to what you said in terms of we are all responsible. So they were arguing, you know, that the Paris Agreement and UNFCCC is the best way of dealing with it because it requires cooperation. And it does kind of, you know, this is, I'm a climate litigator, and one of the kind of incredible, I think, myths or narratives, which have even been reproduced by courts of law, which are courts of fact, is that we're all responsible. And it drives me crazy. Because that is not the case. And so a key pillar of Vanuatu's argument was to actually put on evidence to show the percentages that certain states, the percentage of their greenhouse gas emissions. So I think we've got, you know, the United States around 20%. It's quite a large amount. And so when you look at it, you could probably say the G20 is responsible for the majority of greenhouse gas emissions. And it just actually does undermine that argument that we're all responsible. But of course, the other aspect is that they don't want to pay any price. Like, they don't want to pay for any of the pollution or the damage that they've caused. And that's also why they want to look at keep it within the Paris Agreement and the UNFCCC, because the Paris Agreement and UNFCCC does not deal with liability.
Yes.
So who's responsible? And it has been a fight for 20 years to set up a loss and damage fund. There's continual pledges that are made by the major states, emitting states.
That's through the COP process.
Yes. That will give you a certain money, which they've never actually done. So you get pledges, then the money doesn't come. And it's not going to be enough anyway. And so that was also the other thing that the Vanuatu was saying is, and why you're looking at this wider body of international law, which is you've already breached international law. You were breaching it well before this date. And once you're the way the international law works, once you're found to have done a wrongful act, then automatically you are required to pay reparation. So obviously that has to be assessed, but it takes it out of this so-called cooperative framework, which is just actually a framework mm-hmm. for the large emitting states, because it's not doing anything. It's mm-hmm. failed. The COP process so far has failed in terms of stopping emissions and in terms of making the polluters pay. And obviously part of our notion is if the polluters are forced to pay, then they're going to be, then they'll start thinking, okay, this is not worth it for us anymore. We're going to have mm-hmm. to do something else.
Yeah.
But if they're not forced to pay, then we're just going to continue on yeah. the way things are. And we're, you know, there's already some discussion now that we're certainly 1.5 is gone. There's some concerns that I saw recently that we're probably even lost two degrees. And that is just catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I want to draw things to a close just because I'm conscious of your time. And this has just been incredible. So we're going to obviously be looking out for the International Court of Justice advisory opinion that should come out perhaps in the middle of this year, but certainly this year, 2025. I've been reflecting on a phrase that you used in the conversation that we recorded in Verabari about climate dispossession. That this is all about climate dispossession. Mm. And also, you said it's making us Western, you know. Mm. So I wanted to just say just a little bit about that. And how does this, you know, what does all this mean for Verabari? Just to come back to where we started.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't really talk about the fact, but that place peoples are also, and you know, this is an inadequate term, but subsistence peoples. Mm-hmm. So people who live off the land, who grow their own food, who will hunt and gather, and that's their traditional economies. And so they're not going and selling their labor to somewhere else. They're just creating, they're doing their own thing, and they're having their own food and ceremonies, etc. And so the dispossessive aspect is the fact that greenhouse gas emissions are affecting the climate and affecting the climate in their place. Mm-hmm. And so it's disrupting or severing that relationship, including the ability to live in a subsistence way. So Verabai, they're having trouble actually growing food there now because of the salinization of the mm-hmm. soil. Mm-hmm. They used to be able to grow their own food. So it does impact their ability to continue to live in this way, which then means that they will have to go and look for jobs mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. enter into that wage relationship and wage labor. And I see that as a dispossessive process mm-hmm. because it's effectively taking their means of life as well as their land. I mean those things are bound together. Yes. You can't separate those things. And so I see that as dispossession as violent and similar to colonial dispossession. Mm-hmm. It just happens in a different way. But for me, it's the same. It's violent. It's the same thing. And people are doing it intentionally because they know what the impacts are.
Yeah.
As we were just saying, greenhouse gas emissions have not reduced. They've actually gone up over this period of time.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you, Fleur. Well, what you're doing and your amazing work is a wonderful inspiration to me and many others. Thank you for taking me along to Verabari and introducing me to just so many amazing things that are happening to tackle, resist, and fight heinous acts of states and corporations that we see in all these places, and particularly in the Pacific. So thank you once again, Fleur, for giving me your time and for coming on Countersign.
Great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.